Hi there, thanks for downloading Between the Lines. And just before the program starts, I'd like to tell you about my colleague Richard Adie and his program Best Practice. It's about getting stuff done at work, like the best way to hold a meeting and the best way to speak to management and survive. Tune in at 12:30 on Sunday or 11:30 every Tuesday, or look for Best Practice on the RN homepage, ABC Radio app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. It's really good stuff. G'day, I'm Tom Switzer. Welcome to Between the Lines. Now, what do Donald Trump and staunch opponents of the Iraq War have in common? Well, they're critics of the Bush-Blair-Howard invasion in 2003. Now, with the Chilcot Report's release a few months ago, we thought it might be a good time to revisit the decision to go to war and reflect on how the architects of that unmitigated disaster should be held to account. Stay with us for my chat with the former diplomat, Alison Bronowski. Also, we'll look into the nature of the Australian relationship with India. Now, it's been enhanced in recent years, so what are the pros and cons of closer ties with Delhi? Our panel will delve deeper into our relationship with India. Plus, something on that presidential debate later in the program. So let's get started. In March 2003, a US-led coalition, including Britain and Australia, invaded Iraq. At the time, George W. Bush, Tony Blair, and John Howard had told their citizens that the war was necessary. Why? Because Saddam Hussein, we were told, was developing weapons of mass destruction. Iraq's WMD could be used against us. But soon, after the Iraqi regime was toppled, it became clear that no such weapons existed. Bush, Blair, Howard, they continued to justify their decision on the basis that it toppled a brutal dictator and removed a serious threat to Western security. Yet by all accounts, the war led to a terrible humanitarian catastrophe, an egregious strategic blunder. Where then is the accountability? The British had their recently released Chilcot Report, the Americans had their Kay Report and the 9/11 Commission, but what about Australia? Well, for more on this, let's hear from one of the leading critics of that war. Alison Bronowski is a former Australian diplomat. She's the author of several books, including Howard's War in 2003 and Allied and Addicted in 2007. She's also a member of the Australians for War Powers Reform. Alison, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure.
Now, no senior official in the US, Britain, or Australia has paid a price for this monumental mistake. How do you account for the failure of accountability?
Well, Chilcot is going to have some very serious ramifications. There's already been debate in Parliament about that, and it is quite likely that there will be legal action against Tony Blair.
There's a legal action for war crimes.
War
because
crimes,
Chilcot doesn't actually
say that,
though,
there are two
though,
possibilities. One is a parliamentary process. Mm-hmm. And the other is a legal process. But coming to Australia, there is no such possibility because, unlike the United States and the UK, Australia has had no inquiry into what the government did. We've had inquiries into the intelligence agencies.
Well, the flood report in 2004, didn't that exonerate the Australian government of political interference in the intelligence assessments?
What the flood report concluded was that they went to war not based on the intelligence that they had, which Flood admitted was weak, thin, and inconclusive. Mm-hmm. But the Jull report is more important, the parliamentary one,
right,
which showed conclusively that the government, Howard and Downer, manipulated the evidence that they did have, which did not make the case for the statements that they made. The statements that Howard and Downer made, and don't forget Downer said anybody who thinks that Saddam Hussein doesn't have weapons of mass destruction is a fool, which puts a lot of pressure on their advisors when the minister says something like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Howard and Downer said those things was explained by the fact that they were absolutely in lockstep with what we now know from Chilcot, was the rhetoric that was agreed between the three parties. They were all singing from the same sheet. And what Howard and Downer said was a little more moderate, a little more guarded, but exactly the same. It wasn't based on the intelligence that they were given.
Now, it's been plain for years that obviously Bush, Howard and Blair were wrong. They took their nations to war on false pretexts of Saddam's WMD. That's a fact. But does that really prove they distorted intelligence findings to justify the invasion? I mean, couldn't you argue to be proven false does not necessarily make one a liar?
Well, that's what people have been arguing about Blair. But the fact is, he misled the parliament and he misled the British people because he was given information that showed that what he was saying to them was not justified. Now, if that's not a lie, I don't know what it is. It's dishonesty. And so misinforming the public, you can call it whatever you like, but that's exactly what Howard and Downer did.
Now, the war supporters would come back and say, well, it wasn't just the US, British and Australian intelligence that pointed to Saddam's WMD. So did the French and the Russian intelligence. So the question here is, were the governments of Chirac and Putin, were they lying too?
Yes, but those people are saying that was the evidence that they had in 1998 when Saddam Hussein did in fact have the capability to make nuclear weapons and the capability to make weapons of mass destruction of other kinds. And by the time the sanctions that were imposed had bitten into Saddam Hussein, mind you, he was a noxious tyrant, but he was also a fool, in Downer's terms, because he kept up this pretense for so long that he actually had these
things. Well, that's right. I mean,
when they were so degraded he didn't have them.
He kept playing these cat and mouse games with the UN weapons inspectors, but he did defy 17 UN resolutions. Again, the war party would say this shows that the war was legal. How would you respond to that?
But it doesn't show the war was legal at all. Defying sanctions is one thing. But the fact was that the antagonists in the invaders of Iraq went in without the Security Council resolution that they would have needed to make it legal. And they distorted what they did have, which applied to a much earlier situation, to say that any attack on Saddam Hussein was thereby justified. Don't forget that the reason that they were going into Iraq was supposed to be to stop him handing his weapons to terrorists, and therefore it was attached to the war on terror. Mm. It's absolute nonsense. Picking off Iraq had nothing to do with Afghanistan, nothing to do with 9/11, nothing to do with al-Qaeda.
Back to accountability. Now, after the invasion, it's true that Bush and Howard were re-elected with increased majorities. Blair was also re-elected with a slightly reduced majority. Mm-hmm. Question, isn't the will of the people evidence of some sort of accountability here?
The will of the people was affected in those cases by two things. A khaki election, that is, electors don't often vote against a government soon after the government has sent troops to war. That's been proved many times in Australia, certainly. The other is, in all those three cases, the government had presented the people with false information about Saddam Hussein. In other words, they had kind of propagandized their own electors for years, knowing exactly what they were going to do. This was planned 2 years in advance. And they built up the case, or sexed up the case, as a British advisor said, to make the case for war and convince the people that it was necessary.
You're listening to Alison Brunowski and me, Tom Switzer, on whether we need a Chilcot-style report into our own involvement in the Iraq war. Alison, what does the evidence suggest? Did John Howard lie?
Well, as I said before about Tony Blair, deceiving the public and deceiving the parliament in parliamentary language is not called lying, but I don't know what else it is.
Well, I was going to say, a lie is a lie if it is uttered with intent to deceive. Now, I speak to Howard quite a bit about this. We test wits with each other on this issue endlessly. He will argue that to continue to say they believed what they were saying about Saddam's WMD to be true, that doesn't make it a lie.
But they also said that they were given information on which they made these statements. Now, if you look at the information they were given, and Chilcot now shows this, that is a lie, because Chilcot shows that they were advised time and again that both the legality and the weapons reasons were false. The things that they were saying to the parliament and to the people were false, and their own advice that they received told them that. And I can't believe that Australia wasn't privy to all of the things that Tony Blair was told by MI5 and by his legal people. And don't forget that one of the people in what would be the Attorney General's department here resigned over this because her evidence had been so distorted. Now, Blair was right across what Howard was being told, and so was Bush. They were all on the same page, and they were deceiving their own people deliberately. And if that's not lying, I don't know what it is.
How would you respond to the argument, Alison, that a Chilcot-style report here in Australia would not really amount to much? Because unlike the US and Britain, let's face it, we did not pay a high price in blood and treasure. And besides, the Labor opposition has no interest in bringing up the issue. They're more focused on the banks. How would you respond to that?
I would say, first of all, that there is growing interest among Labor in having a Chilcot-style inquiry. We're talking to them all the time, and particularly now that their position in opposition is so slender, we are now beginning to have quite a lot of interest, particularly from the Labor backbench, in getting an inquiry up.
And by the way, that's not to mention that I think you and your husband, Richard, have pointed out in The Spectator, an article for me two or so years ago, that we're one of the most inquired countries in the world.
We inquire into every damn thing.
Yeah, bats, union corruption, yeah. Detention, and not
one,
war.
And one boy in a jail in Darwin. Mm. You know, we'll have a royal commission, yes, but not into wars. Australia has never inquired into any of our wars, why they happened, what the result was it worth it? And all we do, as Henry Reynolds has pointed out, is say, how well did we fight?
What about the argument that you'll often hear that, okay, everything you're saying is true, but Australia has a very close alliance relationship with the United States. It is our great and powerful friend, as Sir Robert Menzies put it. We had no alternative but to go all the way. How would you respond to that?
I'd say read the ANZUS Treaty. It doesn't say we will. It doesn't say we should go to war with the United States anywhere, anytime, just because they want us to, just as they would not with us. Now, coming back to your other point, though, about why Australia needs an inquiry, even since Chilcot finished collecting his evidence, which was in 2009, we have still been, and they have still been, fighting the same war. So we haven't had any inquiry, and we haven't got anything that brings us right up to date. For instance, Tony Abbott put the troops back in 2014 into Iraq and then into Syria 2015. And most recently, just after the latest election, Malcolm Turnbull, something most people didn't observe, executed mission creep by keeping the RAF bombers attacking Syria, but putting SAS on the ground.
And that's aimed to undermine the Assad regime. And if we bring down the Assad regime, correct me if I'm wrong, but wouldn't that just create a vacuum for the very Sunni jihadists we're fighting?
Exactly. Not only that, but it would be replicating exactly what took place in Iraq. You bring down the government, you leave the place in total chaos, and as Chilcot pointed out, they had no plan of any kind for post-war reconstruction.
Finally, we hardly go through an episode of Between the Lines without mentioning Donald Trump. Let's get your reaction to the Donald's position on this subject.
The war in Iraq, we spent $2 trillion, thousands of lives. We don't even have it. Iran is taking over Iraq with the second largest oil reserves in the world. Obviously, it was a mistake.
So
George Bush made a mistake. We can make mistakes, but that one was a beauty. We should have never been in Iraq.
Alison, does it surprise you that a Republican US presidential candidate is far more likely to agree with you than, say, Hillary Clinton?
It really does. And I find myself quite amazed to agree with anything that Donald Trump said. And by the way, too, he has said the opposite about Iraq earlier.
But nevertheless, this is clearly a winner with a war-weary people, right?
I would think so. And
but isn't that in itself a degree of accountability, Alison?
It could be. But
because the neocons will be marginalised if he's president,
look,
correct?
Accountability is one thing. Legality is another. You don't just invade countries on a whim, no matter how noxious the dictator. Mm. There are noxious dictators all over the place. Why did they pick Saddam Hussein? Well, because he wanted to trade oil in currencies other than US dollars. That's why. Think about it. And furthermore, coming back to Trump, one of the things that makes me feel a little bit better about the prospect of him becoming a president is that he seems to want some kind of detente with the Russians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if that is over Syria, well, good. I mean, it might at least save the suffering people of Syria from having their entire country destroyed.
Politics makes strange bedfellows indeed. Alison, thanks so much for being on the show today.
It was a pleasure, Tom.
That was former diplomat Alison Bronowski, a member of the Australians for War Powers Reform.
On RN, this is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
India, the first third world country, and it remains the greatest and most interesting of them. But only until recently has India really seized the American and Australian imagination. Now, thanks to Presidents Bush and Obama, India figures large in the political and strategic calculations in Washington. Thanks to Prime Minister Tony Abbott, India has featured significantly in our recent foreign policy deliberations. Why? And should Canberra elevate the defence ties? A new report published by the US Studies Centre says so. David Brewster is the author of that report, Australia, India and the United States, the challenges of forging new alignments in the Indo-Pacific. He's also a senior research fellow at the National Security College at the Australian National University. And Ranveet Pawar joins us from Delhi. She's the director of the South Asia Studies at Deakin University. Ranveet, David, welcome to Between the Lines.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
David, why is India becoming an important security partner for both Australia and the United States?
Yeah. As you probably know, Australia and India are not traditional security partners. And for many decades, the two countries mostly operated in very different strategic spheres. Essentially, they looked past each other. But now we're seeing a very different region developing in which India will be one of the key players. And it's part of what we in Australia are calling the Indo-Pacific, where there's a lot more interactions and strategic interdependency right along across the Asian littoral. And the key players in this are China and India, who are just really starting to rub up against each other in our neighbourhood. So this makes them a very important factor.
So you say Canberra should follow the US and enhance strategic relations with India?
Yes. Well, Australia has been enhancing our relations with India for about a decade, as has the US. But there really hasn't been much coordination between the three. And I'm saying now it's time to bring the three together.
Now, you recommend a trilateral defence and security partnership. How would that work?
Well, it'll operate on several different levels. There's the political level, but probably more importantly is the operational level. What I'm saying is that the Indian and Australian and US militaries need to be working much more closely together, practicing together, developing interoperability together so they can work together to confront regional crises.
Now, David, some skeptics will say that this strategy might just upset our largest trading partner, China. How would you respond to that?
Well, first, we should say it's not just about China. The three countries have a lot of issues that they need to address together. Secondly, China is an important factor in the relationships. And this needs to be understood that China's recent actions are causing a lot of new security relationships to develop right across the Indo-Pacific. And these are one of them. Thirdly, I'd say it's really not a matter of upsetting China or not. We need to take actions in accordance with our own needs, and whether or not we're upsetting China is not really the test.
Ranveet, you've heard all this. What's your response?
Well, I think I agree with David that I think we are moving into a new world. The relationship between India and Australia, you know, is a recent one. You know, over the decade, we've actually grown to know each other and work with each other at all areas. I think even trade, economic, and as well as security issues. It's a new world coming together, in my view, from where we sit here in India, because India is starting to exercise its understanding of, you know, being an important player in the market. And I think under this government, we are starting to feel that, you know, the government is wanting to exercise its rights and not just be a player which talks about, you know, just the regular base of, yes, we want to be a peace-loving country. We are a peace-loving country, but we are looking at enhancing and strengthening, you know, our partnerships with our neighbourhood, but yes, also with the powers of the world.
Is Modi reaching out to Washington, Canberra, and indeed Tokyo because India's more nervous about China than ever?
I don't think India is nervous about China, I would say, but India is saying we are tolerant, but we don't want to be overridden. We want to say that we respect the dominance of other countries, but we don't want to be treated, you know, where anybody can just walk over India. I think that's the sentiment that's coming out of this government. You know, whenever you hear these debates over the news or you talk to politicians, the first thing that comes out is that we've had enough, you know, from some parts of the world around us. And that's where I think Modi is starting to build his own allies to figure out where India stands and what's the support India can get.
David, is China really likely to be an expansionist threat to the region beyond the South China Sea? After all, it faces daunting domestic challenges, economic, environmental, demographic. A Lowy poll a year or so ago said that China was, quote, Australia's best friend in Asia. I mean, this is going to be the response to your thesis that why get so close to India when it could upset our relations with Beijing?
Look, I wouldn't necessarily use the word expansionist in relation to the Indian Ocean region, but they're certainly on track to become a major power in that region. They've just opened a new military base in Djibouti, which is their first overseas base, and we're probably going to see a lot more Chinese military bases in the region. Their One Belt, One Road project is on track to change the dynamics of the region, and I actually foresee China developing a military presence in many parts of Pakistan. And this worries India in particular a lot, and we're already seeing them responding to this by threatening to destabilize Baluchistan. So China's actions in the region have a lot of impact, and it impacts India in particular.
You're on RN's Between the Lines. You're listening to David Brewster from ANU in Canberra and Ranveet Parra from Deakin University in Melbourne and in India. Ranveet, is Modi right to shake off India's traditional position of strategic neutrality?
I think he has to be very careful because India is a complex country and India actually has its own issues which could be leading to, you know, a greater problem internally. But I think he's right in the way he's progressing. He's going softly and surely to some places. But I really think that the Indian people are also starting to understand the complexities of the region. Like David said, you know, China is exerting itself. US is dilly-dallying. It's not giving a sense of strong hand-holding. Mm-hmm. Pakistan is, you know, sort of destabilizing the region. India is trying to see where its position is and what stand it needs to take. So I actually think that, yes, Modi is in the right direction because we've got to see a more stable world.
Yes.
And unless the powers get together, and, you know, when one country feels that we've got it all and we don't need anyone else in the world to tell us what to do, we could have problems.
Does Modi's foreign policy activism, Ranveet, does that have widespread support in the Indian community?
By and large, it does. People out here are understanding the fact that it is a destabilized region, could become worse, and we need, you know, the powers of the world to come together. So I feel that, yes, he's getting support from people, but he's still got a long way to go because the opposition here is always looking for, you know, things to say against the current nature of the government. And there are internal issues that he's got to deal with. So he does have support, but he's still got to go a long way.
David, would hosting US forces on Indian soil, even for short visits, to what extent would that spur much protest?
Look, I think Indian views on cooperation with other countries are changing very, very quickly. But I think there would still be very strong opposition to hosting US forces on Indian soil. And that's not really been suggested by anyone at all. There was a recent agreement between India and the United States in which each could provide each other with logistical help to their militaries, but certainly no one's contemplating at this stage that US forces would be hosted on Indian soil.
And well, in fairness, the closer strategic relationship between Washington and Delhi, it complements their closer commercial ties. Ranveet, US investment in India grew by 500% in the past 2 years. Two-way trade between these countries has skyrocketed. Question, is there much domestic support for Modi's plans to open up India's economy to more foreign competition?
Yes, there is more support from India at the moment for Modi's policy to open up the Indian economy further on. I think he's doing two things at the same time. He's also stabilizing the country, and he's also giving robust planning and implementation, strategic way forward to the country more domestically. At the same time, he's not ignoring the fact that we are a global player and we are a global economy. So we can and we should interact with the world more aggressively. So I think he's got his focus domestic as well as international. And, you know, there are all kinds of parties and people. There are some parties that are criticizing the fact, especially the left, to talk about how he's only focusing on foreign policies. But I don't think that's actually true. I think he's pretty focused on domestic as well as international affairs. Having coming back to the question about the U.S. forces on the ground here, you know, I'd just like to make a point. I do think that that could be one aspect that could upset a lot of Indians if that ever happened, because traditionally, you know, the Indian system, the cultures are a lot about being neutral and peace loving. And in the past, the history has told us that US has done that to a lot of countries, which has not been in the best interest of that particular country. So I think we have to be very careful in what we say yes to and what we say no to when we are discussing with the US.
And meanwhile, David, your paper comes out at a time when doubts in the region about US staying power clearly grow. We've had a US Study Center report a few months ago. We had a program dedicated to the polling that showed a lot of doubts about American staying power. Does Modi's look to the West suggest he has confidence in US capacity and will in the Asia Pacific for the foreseeable future?
Modi's look to the United States indicates how important the United States is in the region, and India's realization how important it is to keep the United States in the region. So Modi is engaging with the United States partly as an exercise to keep them in the region and to reinforce the US presence here by developing a new web of security relationships with US allies, including Japan and including Australia.
Fascinating. And Ranvit, at the same time as Modi's looking to the West, Washington, Canberra, and of course beefing up relations with Japan, it's worth pointing out that he skipped the recent non-aligned movement in Venezuela, right?
Yes, he does. And he sends his foreign minister, doesn't he?
He's only the second Indian leader to snub this group since Nehru started it, what, more than half a century ago?
Yes, I think his message is that it's a new world, you know, and India is a dominant country and we are moving towards, you know, looking at relationships and alliances with the world and not just, you know, the same old, same old. So that's what his messaging, I think, is about.
Ranvit, David, thanks so much for being on Between the Lines.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
That was David Brewster from ANU and Ranvit Power from Deakin University. Now to our recommended lists, and what else but the Donald? Now, the media conventional wisdom once again declared Trump the loser in this week's presidential debate. Yet one thing we should have learnt from the last 15 months is that one should be reflexively skeptical of the so-called experts. Now, this is especially so when it's highly unlikely that a large segment of the more than 80 million Americans tuning into the debate, whether they actually watched the entire 90 minutes. But one thing's clear, they would have watched the first 15 minutes, and it's here the novice Trump excelled and the experienced Clinton floundered.
And Hillary, I just ask you this. You've been doing this for 30 years. Why are you just thinking about these solutions right now? For 30 years you've been doing it, and now you're just starting to think of solutions.
Well, actually,
I will bring back jobs. You can't bring back jobs.
Well, actually, I have thought about this quite a bit.
Yeah, for 30
and
years.
I have, well, not quite that long. I think my husband did a pretty good job in the 1990s. I think a lot about what worked and how we can make it work again.
Well, he approved NAFTA.
3 million new jobs.
He approved NAFTA,
balanced budget,
which is the single worst trade deal ever approved in this country.
Incomes went up for everybody.
Now, for more on that debate, Shimon Peres, who died this week, and those joint Chinese-Russian naval exercises in the South China Sea, frankly, they deserve more attention. Go to our recommended list, just abc.net.au/rn, and follow the prompt to Between the Lines. And while you're there, you can hear this episode and back issues. So that's all for this week's edition of Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. Hope you can tune in again next week.